Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 9th of February 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted to be joined today by Alex Thompson and David Scott. Special day today, common purpose and great things happening for women.
Absolutely. A common purpose. This, of course, goes back a couple of weeks to the Franco-British summit, which took place in January. Just looking today at, we'll come on to why we're mentioning this today, but I was just looking through the various documentation that came from this Franco-British summit, and I thought it was just worthwhile having a look through it, because you'll understand the context in a second. On security and defence, the summit, they produced a document which said, the United Kingdom and France are Europe's two leading defence powers with independent nuclear deterrence, full-spectrum armed forces capable to deploy and operate alone or with allies and partners across the world, on land, at sea, in the air, and increasingly today in cyberspace. We both sustain important defence industrial capabilities essential to Europe's defence and security. We have consistently shown both the will and ability to promote and defend our interests and support global peace and stability and the rules-based international system. Both nations have shown national resilience in the face of recent terror attacks. The enduring threats we face are the same, and so and will be so in the coming years. I'm not sure how they know that, but that's what they say. Then they say, this common purpose and capability is the heart of the 2010 Lancaster House Treaties, and it is not new. Later this spring, we mark the centenary of the first placement of both our armies under a single command, with Marshal Foch's appointment in 1918 as Supreme Commander of the Allied Armies in France. Today, following the successful implementation of the measures announced at the Lancaster House Summit in 2010 and at subsequent summits, our armed forces have reached an unprecedented level of integration. Since the last summit at Amiens in March 2016, our armed forces have been working increasingly closely together. This included strengthened marine cooperation in the Channel and the Atlantic. And during 2017, a French armoured infantry company forming part of the UK-led NATO Enhanced Forward Presence Battle Group in Estonia. It included working closely together as leading members of the International Coalition Against Daesh in Syria and northern Iraq. It included supporting each other and providing humanitarian relief in the Caribbean during Hurricane Irma. Our navies operating increasingly closely around the world. The appointment of British and French brigadiers as deputy commanders of one FR division in Besançon and one UK division in York, respectively. The UK providing continuing strategic transport flights in support of French operations in Africa. Full validation of the Combined Joint Expeditionary Force. Our new ministerial council, which is going to meet regularly, apparently every 3 months or so, and this will be supported by an enhanced defence policy dialogue. Apparently, Britain and France will achieve full operating capability for the Combined Joint Expeditionary Force in 2020. We will maintain our independent nuclear deterrence to ensure credible deterrence against threats to our vital interests in extreme circumstances of self-defence, now and in the future. And they go on to say we will develop the Joint Nuclear Commission for a strategic discussion on nuclear deterrence policy. Now, the Joint Nuclear Commission has existed since 1992, and that's been about collaboration between France and the UK in the coordination of nuclear policy and doctrine, but that's now going to be developed. They're going to enhance further maritime cooperation, and they've agreed a package of practical measures to improve cooperation between military intelligence services. And they also agree to sustain a continuing programme of military capability cooperation in our mutual interest. This is the common purpose, Brian, and it just increasingly seems like we are one country.
We are one country. UK column warned about this from way back in 2011 when we picked up on that 2010 Franco-British Council meeting. This is the integration of the nations, and the reason that we keep talking about what is happening to British military and British defence is that, of course, once they have been locked into this Franco-British EU military unification system. We no longer exist as a nation state. So this is common purpose. This is the real common purpose. We are now into the final destruction of the constitution of this country.
And just to clarify this question in the chat box, just to clarify that what I've just read is language from one of the various documents that was released following the Franco-British summit. I think it was the 18th of January yeah. this year. But it continues, because here we've got a tweet from Lord Llewellyn. Good meeting with the House of Commons Defence Committee and Lords EU External Affairs Subcommittee just now, underlying the strength of British-French defence relationship. They are continuing to develop this. This is part of the relationship with the European continent, which is going to be of greater depth and breadth than we've ever seen before.
Yeah, do we know where that photograph is taken,
that particular one? I don't know where that is. That's the Home Office, according to... Foreign Office,
right.
According to Alex.
Yeah.
But it goes on, because here we've got... Alex is describing this as a suborned submariner. This is Steve Kershaw, former submariner, now leads PricewaterhouseCoopers portfolio and program management business, and is chairman of PricewaterhouseCoopers military network. All views are his own, and he says he's looking forward to chairing a panel on elevating Franco-British cooperation in the aerospace supply chain this morning at the British Embassy in Paris. And Brian, this is spectacular.
So we've got an auditing company, albeit a very big one, with fingers in all sorts of pies, which is now setting our defence policy in secret at the British Embassy in Paris. Clearly, we do not have a working parliament anymore. This is the real government.
Absolutely, and we've got to remember that the Lancaster House treaties, which we were talking about a few seconds ago, 2010, those were announced by the new government at the time, jointly by David Cameron and his sidekick, Nick Clegg, at the time. Of course, no parliamentary scrutiny over those documents, those treaties. Brought us into a 50-year defence pact with the French. Much of the negotiation over that took place in secret at the British Embassy in Paris.
Yeah. I'll just interject there, Mike, to say to our audience, we know that we've got a small microphone problem. We can't do anything about it while we are live, so bear with us. But we do know that you're experiencing some audio problems.
So maybe bring Alex in at this point. Welcome to the programme. Alex, have you any thoughts on what we've just discussed?
Well, the main one is that this is an indication of David Ellis's research success. I'm seeing all kinds of stuff in the French press and the German press, both acknowledging that France is taking the lead. Germany is too bogged down with its questions about how to absorb huge numbers of migrants. And so as a result of that, the French press is crowing and saying, we're going to take the lead. Historically, it's been for 4 centuries and more, France, which has wanted to take this lead. They have now got their claws well into the Balkan region, the Eastern Mediterranean, the Levant, and North Africa, the Maghreb, all their old colonial areas. And now going in really for the kill, as I said on that last slide there. We'd be very grateful if people could go back to that slide or find the tweet by Mark Llewellyn, FCO, itself, and help us to identify some of the people, the slide before that, because I tried to match them up this morning, and I could find only on the front row in the left, the Asian lady there is Baroness Verma. She's the only member of the Lord's EU External Affairs Committee, subcommittee that I could find who's there. Possibly Lord Dubs in the middle, but the rest of these figures are not their lordships. There's 3 MPs I could find, most notably the photogenic Johnny Mercer, the Plymouth MP, in the bottom right there, who are members of the committee. I don't know who the general is. It's not General Sir Nick Carter, who's been involved in much of this before. And some of these people may be FCO hangers-on or even Franco-British Council hangers-on. I think one to the rear may be Gavin Williamson, the DUP MEP, MP, sorry. But we need to know from viewers, please, if you can, who these remaining people lurking in the middle are, particularly the Eminence Grise among them, because this is a stitch-up now which is involving corporations and the Franco-British Council acting through the Foreign Office and in the Foreign Office's premises, both in London and in Paris. So it's an extremely troubling situation. Clearly, PESCO outright is not going to work for Britain in the current political climate. And as I said a moment ago, that is precisely because David Ellis has been so successful. He and a few other independent men of his ilk who are talking about the right things in defence, he'd probably be too modest to say this himself, but they are really being gone for now by the machine and being attempted to be compromised, suborned and co-opted in various ways. Fortunately, they're too integral and intelligent to fall for it. But you really need to keep doing what David Ellis suggests and Brian yesterday. Keep plugging this and go to the Twitter feeds of the culprits and post something under that because they can't get rid of it.
Yep. Alex, thank you very much for that. Interesting that the general in that photograph is in uniform, whereas, of course, the early Franco-British meetings which took place at the British ambassador's residence in Paris were all done where the military were in lounge suits. And I said at the time, I believe that this was it was an attempt to deflect those serving military officers from the fact that what was really taking place was treason. Well, that's my opinion anyway.
Right. This is another one for Alex. This is the Washington Post, and the hero is Hero or Hired Gun. This is from a couple of days ago. How a British former spy became a flashpoint in the Russia investigation. This is over Russiagate in the United States. And Christopher Steele on screen there. Now, I kept this back for the next time Alex was on. Basically, this article is suggesting, is demonstrating links between Christopher Steele and Richard Dearlove, which really I thought Alex was a this is something that I haven't heard in discussion of Russiagate before, that in fact Steele was working with other people, including his former boss at MI6, well, now not, no longer at MI6 himself, of course. But this seems to imply a much greater British interest in undermining Trump than we were otherwise aware of. And then the question has to be, who did interfere, if anybody, in the 2016 general election in the United States? Was it the Russians, or in fact, was it the British? I don't know if you have any thoughts on this.
Well, just to keep it brief, Mike, I would say that the long-term people analysing this in the States, like Lyndon LaRouche and his organisation, have been vindicated here. The Brits are the evil geniuses. The duo who talk as Able Danger, David Hawkins and Field McConnell, have been vindicated. Their analysis is exactly the same and has now been mainstreamed by Lionel Nation and American intelligence media, reaching hundreds of thousands at a time, if not millions. America's waking up to this. We've been in this game since the 16th century. We, together with the powers that be in Rome at that time, basically planned the creation of America, and we were not we were determined not to let it go over the trifling matter of a revolutionary war. Steele, I can now see his whole command chain involved. The one man immediately above him I'm not allowed to name because he hasn't been avowed publicly, and not that I've seen anyway, but Steele's boss of boss was Nigel Inkster, and the boss of that was Sir Richard Dearlove. So in the mid-2000s, 10 years ago or 12 years ago, that entire command chain from C, the head of the code name for the head of MI6, right down to Steele, was involved in touting the idea of the Russian threat and, of course, the Iraqi threat to the Americans. A clique at MI6 took the lead in that. And don't think that it's MI6 institutionally that's to blame, because these were not popular officers within MI6 at the time, I can tell you that. This was a small clique that basically suborned and subverted the constitution of both Britain and America. They've now gone their various ways. Inkster is doing various things like trying to start wars in Russia and North Korea, his old trade, and trying to get into parliament to do that now. Dearlove is obviously touting himself as an anti-Trump. Steele has gone to ground because there's possibly threats to his life, and he may find himself appearing before a grand jury in the US or even worse. It doesn't look good, and the Russians have got very little indeed to do with this.
Alex, just one final point. Just going back to this article for a second, it says that Dearlove said that he advised Steele and Steele's colleague Burroughs to work discreetly with a top British government official, unnamed at this point, to pass along information to the FBI. Right. So you know, this seems to be a bit more than people working independently of their organisations, if they're actually involving allegedly top British government officials in this.
Yes, this is coordinated, and the only place it can be coordinated is number 70 Whitehall, the headquarters of the Cabinet Office. That's always been where the deepest actors have been. Again, not the entire Cabinet Office assessment staff. They're a very upright body, certainly were in my time when I was dealing with them on a monthly basis, if not weekly. But that's where the people who control both number 10, so the Prime Minister's department, and the Foreign Office and the MI6 reside. Cabinet Office and probably someone very senior there would be the unnamed senior official who would talk to the Department of Justice.
Alex, thank you very much for that. I'm just going to put in my penny worth that, of course, is it the British doing this? I prefer to say that we've got these very dark actors within the British nation. Are they really British? I don't believe so. But we've got to judge people by what they say and what they do.
An opportunity to bring David into the programme now because we're going to talk finance for a second. Well, the Bank of England was talking yesterday. They were talking about a stronger global economic outlook. And because of that, they're going to have to raise interest rates further and faster, perhaps. So, David, perhaps we're seeing an end to 0% interest rate policy. You can comment on that in a second. They said that they used to aim to return higher inflation to its 2% target over a period of 2 years, because they describe that as a horizon that they prefer to use because it strikes the right balance between price stability and stable growth. But they've now decided to return to a more conventional horizon, which again suggests that they're going to raise interest rates a bit more quickly. But Mark Carney was really happy to bring the word volatility into his discussion. He didn't want to say it was a welcome addition to the markets, this recent volatility. And on screen at the moment, we have the volatility index, the VIX, showing just what volatility has been doing over the last 6 months and how in the last few days it has jumped such a staggeringly high amount, which is why we're seeing such turbulence on the markets at the moment. But Citibank was writing last night that in the week of the 7th of February, bond funds had an inflow of $4 billion and equity funds lost $30 billion in outflows. This was the largest outflow on record from equity funds, which just had the record high inflow of $33 billion just 2 weeks ago. The largest outflow had come from US funds, which saw $32 billion outflow. So money being taken out of the equities markets as quickly as possible at the moment. Some people suggesting that this is being exacerbated by electronic trading and algorithmic trading. But at the end of the day, do you think that this is going to bring us to the end of 0% interest rate policy, or is this just the crash on its way?
Zero interest rate policy, of course, makes no sense. The idea that you do not have a time preference, you do not prefer goods now rather than the future, makes no economic sense. So we have a system that's based on funny money printing, smoke signals from central banks, and nothing sound. And it's quite unprecedented. So it's difficult to say how it will go down. But they have many problems. The zero interest rate policy, if continued indefinitely, will eventually destroy the currency. And that's not in the Bank of England's interest. So they will seek to stop that. They will act, even if their actions are against the political will, they will act to stop the currency being destroyed. So eventually they realise they have to bring interest rates to something more normal. But the problems they face doing this are enormous, because they'll crash the economy, because it's all based on free money. We've seen smoke signals from the Fed cause a huge loss, the biggest ever points drop in the Dow not that long ago. And we've seen central bankers sit and tell us how that 2% inflation, 2% less purchasing power for ordinary people all around the world is somehow some sort of ideal to be aimed at. There is no soundness in the system, and trying to guess what will happen is very difficult, because we're a long way from anything rational.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Let's move on. Brian, we were talking about George Soros over the last couple of days.
Yep, £400,000 into trying to influence a Remain vote, of course.
But Alex, the Washington Times seems to have got on the bandwagon. This is disruption at home and abroad. Follow the money, part one. And they're saying research shows that billionaire Mr. Soros is spending millions to finance a huge grievance and anarchy industry that pretends to be grassroots justice protests. You can see the recruitment efforts at one of the hiring portals, organizersforamerica.org, where, for example, vulnerable college kids who need extra money can earn cash by creating disruptive events for new groups like Badass Women and Green Corps, as well as the ACLU. So I'm interested in your thoughts as to why the mainstream media seems to be much more prepared to talk about this man at the moment, because in the past they certainly haven't. We've seen criticism of Viktor Orban, for example, criticizing Soros in turn. So it seems a bit strange that they're suddenly shining a light on this, on George Soros.
I think it's two strands of global domination or global revolutionary thinking that are having a slanging match here, Mike. Until now, Soros seemed to suit both agendas, but he is the pure Marxist type of communist subversion, and so obviously it's a bit of a strange nomenclature to use these days, but the old-fashioned nomenclature would be the left-wing elite found that just fine to use identity politics, and so to a certain extent did the nominal right-wing or pseudo-conservatives, the what the Americans call the rhinos, Republicans in name only. But this rhino contingent now, the Washington Times being a fine example, very much different from the Washington Post, which is one of the core Obama supporting and Clinton supporting rags, that the Washington Times and others of its ilk represent a kind of capital that sees its interests threatened by this agitation and the ensuing inability of people to get their employees to work and harmoniously get through a working day. And this also explains, I think, why the people bust in for these protests like the Women's March and various spin-offs haven't got a coherent word to say to the camera when they're asked what they're protesting about. Because as that guest spot article surprisingly appearing in the Washington Times said, they're just bust in because of a Craigslist advert or some other kind of rent-a-mob. And here in quick succession, we've got a lot to get through, we'll just show you a couple of slides of how Soros has done this. You must freeze frame this at home and have a look properly, but this is from earlier this year. An institution, an NGO called Friends for Democracy, which is registered as a PAC, a political action committee, so a political charity, basically, like a Common Purpose is one, but in the American model, this is your way of organising funding in block. These people have sent out a level 6 classified confidential memo. Apparently there's at least 7 levels of this. You can look at all the bits I've highlighted in red in slower time, and I've put a tweet of mine in there. But this is when they were to trash an area just north of BWI Airport, Baltimore Washington International Airport, west of the center of Baltimore City, which is quite a tough city with ethnic problems, a year ago. And as we circle through to the next one, you can see that the instructions they are given include some details on how to fight. Lots of mention of LE, which is law enforcement. They're talking about policemen whom they have either bribed or terrorized into doing nothing, to standing down, not responding, or even letting people sneak through lines and clobber a few heads and turn the other way. This is definitely genuine. You can see it's a scrunched up memo. There's some handwriting additions which give us more detail. And if we go on to the next one. Yes, here we can see the name of David Donnelly, who is, do not name outside this document, but David Donnelly is the man who will be paying you your dollars from Soros, right? And the thing is that if you see the central and right-hand column there, David Donnelly is the treasurer of Friends of Democracy and executive treasurer at law, and in terms of internal title, executive director, same role. But this is, he's basically the nominated money man to receive funds from Soros and from public sources, I understand, in order to disperse them. And he is there in a secret document saying, don't tell anyone that I'm actually paying this out to agitators who are going to trash the streets of Baltimore with police turning a blind eye. It's a pretty spectacular example of what Soros has got up to. And this was leaked earlier this year, but I think it's worth pointing it out at this stage.
As we move into Scottish issues, then you wanted to highlight the fact that Scotland has been selected for open government. Open Government Partnership, Scottish National Action Plan is what we have here.
Yes, we mentioned this today, A, because David's on with me, and B, because yesterday Brian mentioned Open Government Partnership and one of its four organisers, Teodor Tsouloukiani, the Georgian Justice Minister, who spent most of her life being an elite French lawyer before going back to Georgia. So not primarily loyal to Georgia, but to international government. Now, the Open Government Partnership is something that David had previously spotted. Here is a not at all blood-curdling image of Shetland and the Isle of Skye and Dumfries and Galloway promising eternal and undying allegiance to who knows what. But the two bigger shots there are from the Scottish Government itself, and the left-hand icon is the Open Government Partnership. Here, Scottish Government crows in the lower of the two red boxes on that I've put on the right-hand side that it has been selected as one of only 15 governments, most of the rest of which are in the interesting parts of Latin America, the same and Indonesia and Southeast Asia, the same countries where the white helmets are now franchising out, basically. And the purpose of this venture, we're told, is that really goody-goody governments that are, for example, better at speaking English than others, are going to pioneer how to get the population to trust them, to move us into a new frame of government, something that David's been reporting on for a while, the Scottish model of government that they're gloating about in the higher of those two boxes. So why is it, and I think I have a slide on this as well, why is it that Scotland is chosen? Well, it's here we have in the Jakarta Post, the Indonesian press, we have Mrs. Tsouloukiani saying, this is the only bit of the article that's open to the public, it's a subscriber only, she's saying, well, her quotes in there are, philosophy is to have a good system. And there she is posing with Asia Pacific leaders. And the opening of the article says that the most crucial thing in this era for government is to gain the trust of the people. And this is why Mrs. Tsouloukiani and others have chosen their 15 goody governments. And just to repeat, they are in the Western Hemisphere, Chile, Mexico, Brazil, not Venezuela, though I think they'll probably come on soon if they can be browbeaten into it, and Canada. And then Britain and France as the kind of buckle of the belt, doing it all the fingers in pies, just like with the white helmets. And then in Asia Pacific, you have Georgia in Western Asia, and then in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Philippines is the concentration. So all the areas with resources and ethnic tensions bubbling to the surface, and with socialistic bents in many cases in the government, they're being told, well, through this open government partnership, you can be in the lead. I think one of the keys to this is that many of their leaders in these countries now are trained in English-speaking institutions, and also a lot of the civil servants can speak English. So the handlers can come out from America and Britain and France and interview them in half-decent English about how they're getting on with reframing their citizens and their citizens' perception of government. Possibly worth inviting David to talk about this, because it's him that spotted first that Scotland was the Open Government Partnership lead for Europe.
David.
I think that's an excellent summary. I would just add one little fact. I did a few weeks ago ask the Scottish Government what their definition of fairness, that main document you showed, there's 100 pages called It Takes All of Us to Build a Fairer Scotland. So I asked them what their definition of fairness was, and I got a response. The Scottish Government has not formally outlined the definition of fairness, as this is subject to the lens or context to which it is attributed. And so they don't have one, but they do go on. Within Fairer Scotland Action Plan, a fairer Scotland was described as one with low levels of poverty and inequality, genuine equality of opportunity, as opposed to equality of opportunity, and don't know the difference there, stronger life chances and support for all those who need it. So a few kind of warm and fuzzy feelings and no definition. And it's always that way under these actions. It's the same under named person. It's the same when you're looking at well-being. Nothing is defined, and that means everything is open to the interpretation of the government and the government officials.
Well, if you want to find out a little bit more about the definition of fairness in this context, get onto the UK Column website, because we do have a couple of articles on this, because it's interesting that this is being discussed in Scotland, but in England there have been fairness commissions being run in various local authorities right around the country. So there's quite a bit of documentation on this that people can look at if they go to the Column website.
Yeah, what an amazing package of information. We've got George Soros funding what is essentially subversion of so-called democracies. All of this is done under a smokescreen so that ordinary people are not supposed to see what's going on, even if it's sort of hidden in plain sight. Well, let's just jump to some good news. And I'm delighted to say that after putting out pleas for people to support ex-Metropolitan Detective John Wedger, the man who did the excellent expose on the cover-up of child abuse. He's after £5,000 to do a walk to highlight abuse of children. That's from London to Manchester. He needs £5,000. And look at that total. It's now jumped up to £2,858, so it's over halfway. If you've already donated, thank you very much. But if you have donated, please continue to share this and ask other people to help this extremely brave man. I think he deserves his £5,000. He's taken incredible risks to say what he said and put his face on camera. So please continue to help. And David, probably a good time to bring you in with the latest on the Fresh Start Foundation.
Yes, the first of the road shows are coming forward. That's Saturday, the 3rd of March. We're going to be in Edinburgh at the Eric Liddell Centre. Brian, you've very kindly agreed to be our keynote speaker at the first event. This is the first of 32 roadshows in the 32 Scottish local authorities. We're also going to the four cities twice, 36 in all, over 2 years. We're starting in Edinburgh, we're finishing in Edinburgh, being the capital city, in 2019. And during this, we're going to meet a lot of people. We're going to meet a lot of people who have a background of having suffered child sexual abuse and Satanist ritual abuse. We're going to meet a lot of whistleblowers, policemen, journalists, and members of the public who want to come along and help. There's a huge amount to do. The speeches over the 36 events, we hope, will outline a great deal of information about how this system is actually working, where it's breaking down, where people are being abandoned. We are the People's Inquiry. We're looking for information. And when we get that information, it's going to be gathered and used in a lawful and appropriate manner.
Right, moving on, David. Freedom of information in Scotland. The Herald here, a bunch of newspapers talking about this. Demand for probe into SNP government meddling in FOI cases. Now, you asked me to queue up a little video clip. Unfortunately, we don't have that. But just take us through this story.
What has come out is this has come out via an FOI that went in regarding some lobbying by Prince Charles on behalf of one of his charities, one of his organisations that he sponsors, and he wanted them to be able to tender for a Scottish Government contract. Someone asked some questions about this. The Minister, John Swinney, intervened in order to stop the Freedom of Information request being answered. Now, this has prompted further examination of this issue. And it transpires that it is now routine for governments to intervene in issues such as this. So this was a question in the First Minister's questions yesterday. The response was very bizarre. The response cited the need for Scottish ministers to intervene and to decide whether FOI responses have clearance, have their clearance. And the First Minister referred to Schedule 1, Part 1, Paragraph 1 of the Act. Now, the full text of which reads the Scottish Ministers, because all Schedule 1 is a list of what its Scottish public authorities include. So, yes, the Scottish Ministers are bound by the Freedom of Information Act. That's all that the piece of Act that was quoted actually means. What is happening is that Freedom of Information requests are being routed through special advisors to the Scottish Government. Multiple special advisors are copied in. If journalists or other selected individuals ask a Freedom of Information request, that FOI request is immediately circulated around multiple special advisors. Special advisors to Nicola Sturgeon, special advisors to the Scottish Government. They are influencing what is released. This is not going to the standard civil service. This has not been handled in the normal manner. This has been handled in a politicised manner in order to control information flow. And it's been done on a wholesale scale. This is now standard practice in the Scottish Government. There is no words in the Freedom of Information Act that give the cabinet ministers any authority to release or not release this data. The information is governed by the Act itself. So it seems like a wholesale political interference in the information that's released.
Yeah, okay.
Deception is the word, to deceive the public.
Yeah, indeed. Right, look, we're really short of time now, so just very briefly on this, the Chief Constable of Police Scotland now has tendered his resignation at last.
Very briefly, if you watch any episode of The Muppet Show, you will get essentially a potted history of Police Scotland. It gets worse and worse. Phil Gormley's gone, Phil Gormley came, and Phil Gormley apparently created the grand strategy for the way forward for Police Scotland, a grand strategy that's not, it's not really been shared with anybody. I'm sure it exists somewhere, but I don't know what it is. And having done this, he's resigned. And we've now had, we've never yet had anybody as Chief Constable of Police Scotland see out their contract. We've had three heads of the Scottish Police Authority, and it just goes from bad to worse. The leadership is appalling. You have to actually feel for the organisation itself and the police men and women on the ground. It's appallingly led, and there is no sign of it stopping.
So he didn't resign because they tried to shoot a stuffed tiger then?
No, I put this in because it's good to know that the armed police, the introduction of armed police into the very peaceful Highlands, you know, was viewed as an infringement on the liberty by many people in the Highlands. But look, they're protecting us from cuddly toys. You see, these people are necessary. They're the only thing that keeps us from societal breakdown and cuddly toys.
David, I know we're tight to time, but I've just got to say that story is particularly scary, of course, because I believe it was Scottish gillies, if that's the right term. It was those stalking deer on the Scottish estates who were first used to train British Army snipers. We could have the British Army now trained to shoot sniper cuddly toys.
Cuddly toys, yeah. Dangerous stuff.
Dangerous.
Right, Brian.
Well, we just bring this one in quickly because we can't say very much, there was a hearing for Mr. Charles Howson last Friday, if I've got my date correct, at which the date for his next trial was set. That's June the 4th, where he's going to face further very serious charges. But essentially, there's restrictions over reporting. So that's all we can say.
Okay. Look, I think we'll skip this one and go straight to Justin Trudeau, David, because apparently we're not allowed to say mankind anymore.
No, we're not. This was really beyond satire. It was in front of a big audience. There was a woman giving a long, quite rambling question come statement along the lines of that women are wonderful and that we need more feminization of society, and it's basically only the female half of society that is going to save us all from the decay of everything. And that, yes, it was basically the feminizing part of humanity that they should be concentrating on. And partway through this quite one-sided speech, Justin interrupted her when she said the word mankind. And he said, no, it's people kind, not even humankind, people kind. And then he said, well, we've got to learn from one another. And she thanked him for the lesson in appropriate PC speech and correcting her for her minor thought crime. And on they went. And then, of course, there was the reaction as the entire world fell about laughing at this nonsense. And he then said, oh, well, that was a joke. That's not true. It wasn't a joke. He got caught out being ridiculous and caught out in a more obvious way, changing the language to frame the debate.
Well, indeed.
Yeah, well, David, I've got some very sad news because today is actually World End of Women Day. Mike has enjoyed bringing up what are important events on a particular day. Today, the UK column is stating is World End of Women Day. And why do we say this? Well, we say it because of this extraordinary headline in the BBC, First Human Eggs Grown in Laboratory. So let's have a look. It's taken decades of work, but scientists can now grow human eggs to maturity outside of the ovary. Requires carefully controlled laboratory conditions, including oxygen levels, hormones, proteins that stimulate growth, and the medium in which the eggs are cultured. Work on mouse eggs, that was nailed 20 years ago.
Nailed. This is the language of the BBC used.
Yeah, this is the experts of the BBC. It was nailed 20 years ago, and it showed the technology could be used to produce live animals. Matching this achievement in human tissue could eventually be used to help children having cancer treatment. So this whole technology of, I'm going to say, growing humans in a laboratory is all been done to help children who've got cancer, apparently.
Yes.
Well, this is the journalist. I always like to bring the person on. So it's James Gallagher. He says that his middle name isn't Tiberius. I don't know why he would think people would consider him a Roman general or emperor, I should say. But there we are. This is some of the other quotes in the article. This work represents a genuine step forward in our understanding. Although still in small numbers and requiring optimization, this preliminary work offers hope for patients. So we're growing human beings on the basis that it offers hope.
Good.
It's good stuff, isn't it? This lady is the one to watch, Evelyn Telfer. It's a very it's very exciting to obtain proof of principle that it's possible to reach this stage in human tissue, but that has to be tempered by the whole lot of work needed to improve the culture conditions and test the quality of the eggs. But apart from any clinical applications, this is a big breakthrough in improving understanding of human egg development. I read some of this stuff. It just got more and more sinister. Here you can read some information about her. She's University of Edinburgh. And then it tells you that the money comes from the Medical Research Council for most of her research projects. So viewers and listeners need to research this themselves. Here's the Medical Research Council. If you have a look at it, it very quickly starts talking in corporate terms. The council is the MRC's governing body and directs and oversees corporate policy. It decides all the issues of major importance, including issues of corporate strategy, key strategic objectives and targets, etc. Tells you about the chairman, tells you about council members, supported by the Secretary of State for Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. This is about growing human beings, but it is featured in business, energy and industrial strategy. Do you get a warm feeling there?
Absolutely.
Well, we're okay because we're men and this is going to replace women. So have a look at some of the people. What do you find? Stock exchange, ex-bankers, ex-drug company individuals. A lot of questions to be asked here. I've just put up another one, Dr. John Brown. We've got medically trained people, but they're all working or were working with the drug companies. Certainly one at least of these individuals is still working on big drug company projects. And this will lead us through into this sort of thing, controversies in obstetrics, gynecology and infertility. So an organisation which is a congress which has been set up to help deal with maybe difficult issues around the substance of the growing of human beings in laboratories. And here we find Evelyn again. She's in the middle of that. Here's the organisation. Bring in the main man who started it all, Professor Zion Ben Raphael. And if you have a look at him, he's linked back to Tel Aviv University. And this one man seems to be very powerful in this whole scene. What is his morality? What does he believe in? We don't know. So take it full circle back to our journalist. What is he talking about on his Twitter page? Well, he's talking about this. He's very worried that the Wellcome Trust is not paying its women as much as it is men. But I don't see what the problem is, because they're not going to be any women around. They're going to be replaced by an industrial program. This was one of the comments from his article. It would be It would be legal to fertilise one of the lab-made eggs to create an embryo for research purposes in the UK, but the team in Edinburgh do not have a licence to carry out the experiment. They're discussing whether to apply to the embryo authority for one or collaborate with a centre that already has one. So we've gone from eggs to embryos in one stage. And why do we need to pay attention? Well, Graham Downing warned us about this, the fact that the Japanese were boasting they were already growing goats, young goats. These are live young goats being grown in the laboratory. Fetuses have stayed in the environment for up to 3 weeks. And this particular Japanese expert, Mr. Kawabawa, says, and yes, this can be extended or applied to human beings. Ectogenesis was a term created by British scientist Haldane in 1924. By 2074, human pregnancy would be obsolete and artificial wombs would be the norm. Well, we're only in 2018. And then they say, of course, many people are already throwing out their concerns with this prospect. Most complaints have been that if women's wombs are obsolete,
then they will soon be too.
Thank you. Considering we have yet to replicate human ova, I think we're in the clear. Well, of course, all of those things have now been made obsolete. So there we are. Women are clearly going to be replaced. This is transhumanism. And here we've got an MP. I've chosen this example. So we've got Nikki Morgan. I'm calling her a lemming. Because what is she talking about? The gender pay gap, when the reality is they are about to get rid of women across the board. David, this is horrific stuff. It's happening in plain sight. I almost don't know what to say on this, by the fact that the BBC drifts it in as though it's a bit of fun. We're going to grow human beings in laboratories.
Well, you see the gap between the ability, the technical ability, and any sort of ethical restraint, any sort of wisdom, any sort of philosophical understanding of what we should be doing as human beings to guide that power. This is, intellectually speaking, this is the Tower of Babel. Yep. You know, if they're doing this, they will be able to do whatever they wish.
Whatever they wish.
Nothing. Yep. Nothing restrained, nothing withheld from them. What will they do next? This is extremely worrying, and once again, University of Edinburgh.
Indeed. Alex, 30 seconds and we must close.
It's becoming clear to me, Brian, that the science fiction writers of the post-war era, Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Brian Aldiss a little later, were not asking questions in the dark when they asked what is it to be human, and talking about particularly the android side of transhumanist agenda, but also to some extent the ectogenesis. Because as Haldane said, between the wars and George Bernard Shaw, and we can go even further back to the 1870s generation and H.G. Wells, the father of science fiction, these were books written to condition us to something. And the state of technology they were describing in the first half of the 20th century may actually clandestinely have been at that level, certainly by mid-century, the latter part of last century. This may be a disclosure of something that's already a mature technology on the inside. Yeah.
Thank you very much for that. Three comments. Please consider making a donation to Ian Crane. Ian needs some financial support at the moment. Please help if you can, because he's doing such wonderful work out there on the fracking campaign. Yes, you can walk with John Wedger when the details of his walk from London to Manchester are set up. And somebody's asked about the NSPCC Speak Out Stay Safe programme, which is beginning to be pushed out around schools. We would say be very, very careful, because anything that any parent says will be reported through to social services. So take care. If you want more, please contact the UK column on that one. That's it for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Bye-bye.